The Tom Woods Show, episode 2036.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, Tom Woods here. Don't forget you can get one of my books in audiobook format for free. So that includes my book, Real Descent, which is narrated by me. My New York Times bestseller, Meltdown on the Financial Crisis of 2008, featuring a foreword by Ron Paul, Nullification, and others. Just head over to tomwoodsaudio.com, sign up for Audible, and if you decide you don't want Audible, you get to keep the free audiobook they give you anyway. tomwoodsaudio.com. Hey folks, Tom Woods here. Michael Malice Week continues. We're going to talk a bit today about Michael's appearances on various programs, but I think in particular on Glenn Beck, because that was a really, really great interview. I'll link to it on the show notes page. And let me say something also to people who may have started to listen to me because of COVID, and they're a little shocked that we're casually discussing anarchism here. I'll say a couple things. First, on the show notes pages for this week, I'll have episodes of the Tom Woods Show that go into more detail about how would this work, how would that work. But just think of everything other than COVID as being like a mini COVID. It's driven by irrationality, and there are special interests at work that pretend that they're just looking out for the common good. There's money sloshing around, even though we're told that all the various things that are done by the state are done for our benefit. Like every aspect of the COVID thing that makes you crazy, it exists in microcosm on basically every other issue. Fanaticism, weirdness, crazy people ruling over you, crazy people convincing you that without them ruling over you, where would you be? Society would be governed by warlords and all the rest of it. Well, I don't know. Some of us are just not convinced by that. So what Michael and I are talking about is a system without a state. That is true. And that is going to shock some people. But I'll bet the idea for some of you that you cannot listen to the Centers for Disease Control would have been shocking 2 years ago. I bet that would have shocked some of you 2 years ago. So the threshold for what is shocking is not what it was. Let's say that. The way I look at it is this. The free market is an unbelievable engine of prosperity and of wise stewardship of property, because a genuine free market requires people to consider the long-term capital value of property so they don't just act like politicians who have no particular interest in maintaining the long-term capital value of anything, because they're only, as Hans Hoppe would say, temporary caretakers of things. So what possible interest do they have in preserving the long-term capital value of, for example, the United States? Why wouldn't they just want to blow through money and resources in the immediate term, because that's what gets them votes? Is that the best possible system? Is it conceivable that there could be some other kind of system? Is that conceivable? Again, I realize this is going to be shocking to some people. But remember what I said. I'm sure you're willing to entertain ideas now that you weren't 2 years ago. So it's time to continue down that path. And as I say, I've got some episodes that go into the nuts and bolts of this in some detail. But really, it's just a matter of the free market. If the free market works, then it works. No exceptions. If it works, it works. So anyway, Michael Malice, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom.
All right. I want to talk about communicating ideas. I saw somebody on Twitter say to you, Michael, how do I talk about anarchism to my relatives at Thanksgiving? And you basically told the person, you don't.
I said they're a bad person, I think. I think I was much more condemnatory.
You might have been, but I distinctly recall look, you're just going to ruin their day and your day, and they're not going to be able to hear the ideas anyway.
You know what it is? You and I have different tastes in music. Of what value would it be to me, other than maybe you and I would go to a concert sometime, for you and me to have the same taste in music? There's no value in it to be had at all. It doesn't affect our friendship or our relationship. And I think people who are passionate about politics, it would benefit them to understand that, you know, there's that expression, this band could be your life. And there's many bands that, you know, mean the world to me and have been there for me for 20 years. And, you know, there's some albums that I can revisit and I still get new things out of them. I'm sure that's the same for you and for most people listening.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it is fun. Like when you're with your family or loved ones and you can sit down and, you know, hate the same people politically, so on and so forth. But to have this be a need is really something I fundamentally disagree with. And I don't think it adds, and especially if you're just finishing each other's sentences, oh, you know, I hate Trump. Yeah, Trump. I hate Kamala Harris. Oh my God. It's just like, you can't get enough of that elsewhere.
I mean, I suppose the way they're thinking is, I have all these blue-pilled relatives, and it would be great if they saw the world the way I did, because then when they talk to their friends, they'll spread these ideas, and instead of spreading destructive stupidity. But there are at least two responses to that. Number one, I think going at a blue-pilled person with anarchism, you are trying to undo every layer of knowledge they think they have that's been put in their brains their entire life. That would not be fruitful. But secondly, we're overestimating the significance of your friend or your family member. If you spend the rest of your life, which is what it would take to bring them around, what has that accomplished as compared to what you might have spent that time doing, you know, otherwise? Write a book, you know, give speeches, do something, organize.
Yeah, and there's this game on The Price is Right, which I haven't watched that show in decades, but I'm sure they probably still play this game, where you were given, like, I think, like $10 bills, right? So $10 total. And you have to guess the price of the car digit by digit.
Oh, it's Lucky Seven. Yeah, you get seven $1 bills, and then you can buy the car with your remaining dollar. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Somebody on this call watched Price is Right in great detail.
Yeah, yeah, as did I. I was a huge Plinko fan. When Plinko happened, I would just lose my mind.
Oh, there's a great episode. It might have been after the Bob Barker era, unfortunately, where Snoop Dogg is showing somebody how to do Plinko.
Oh, that's amazing.
It was great. All right, anyway, go ahead.
So let's suppose the first digit of the car is, it's a $20,000 car, right? And you guess it's three, it's actually two, you hand over a dollar. And the second digit is six, and you guess it's eight, you hand over $2, right? So you have to have a dollar left. That's how, when you have any kind of worldview that is removed from what someone's perception of normalcy is, everything you say is like handing over a dollar. And after a certain point, they can't follow you, and they regard you as someone that they are uncomfortable with and untrustworthy. It's like you only have so much leeway before, instead of it being, oh, this is something I'm interested in, who is this person? I can't follow their mental thought processes, therefore I don't feel comfortable around them. It's a great way to alienate yourself from your friends and family who have been trained since kindergarten to believe that people who stray outside the index card of allowable opinion is a bad person, or at least not like us.
Yeah, I think that is the right way to think about it. But meanwhile, let's say, and now maybe we can, I want to say a little something about your interview with Glenn Beck, which I will link to on the show notes page. We'll put that, let's see, what episode number would this be? This would be 2036. So I'll put at tomwoods.com/2036. If somehow you missed, not the time when Glenn Beck was on your show, but when you were on with Glenn Beck on his program, that got a lot of buzz when you were talking about anarchism with him, because he was listening very respectfully and intently and saying, you know, actually saying that you were influencing him, you were pulling him, and that this is what he wanted, and that this is just great. It was a really, really great performance. The way I approach this kind of thing is I wouldn't, first of all, go up to somebody who shares no basic premise with me and then try to overturn their entire worldview over the course of a meal. It would just be not a good use of my time. And it wouldn't be productive. But I would find it interesting, though, to talk to somebody who believes in the Constitution and limited government and this and that, because I think I know how to talk to those people, because I used to be one of those people. You know, and my approach there would be to say, all right, think of the way you analyze everything else in life, whether it's the sale of shoes or the offering of horseback riding services or whatever. You understand instantly why it makes sense for people to do those things voluntarily. Okay, just apply the same analysis to everything that you, without really thinking about it that deeply, have just automatically assumed have to be handled by the state. Exactly the same analysis applies to it. And the so-called public goods argument in favor of why we need government control is just a mountain of lies and propaganda. And once I do that and they see that I'm on their side, I believe in private property more than they do, I'm out-propertying them, then they'll be more likely to listen to me. And so I can make a little bit of progress that way. And I feel like the way you were dealing with Glenn is you didn't say that his concerns were stupid, but that the current system doesn't address them any better. I mean, I don't want to get into the nukes question, But he did ask you, what would we do with the nukes? And that, look, that's a challenging question for anybody. But the key thing is the current system says, let's entrust the nukes to literally the worst people in the world. That's our current system. You know, so you got to get people out of that way of thinking and see that actually their own goals and desires are more likely to be realized.
You're saying we're entrusting the nukes to the Tom Woods supporting listeners group?
Yes, we are. So far, it's worked out okay.
Yeah, this changes everything.
This changes everything. Well, first of all, tell me about, I mean, you must have walked out of there feeling really good about that interview. It went great. The two of you guys couldn't have been more at ease, and it was friendly and interesting and challenging at the same time.
Let me talk a little about that. So Glenn's office, The Blaze, they're in Dallas. I'm, as you know, here in Austin. So I wake up every day at 11. They wanted me, because it's not that often that they have people in studio. So when they have people fly in, they want them to do the whole suite of shows, right?
Oh, okay.
So I had Glenn in the morning, then Sarah Gonzalez, who's a pistol. She's absolutely adore that woman. And then Stu Berger, who might be one of the most amiable people I've ever met. Like, it's hard for me to imagine someone not liking Stu to the point where I can only imagine maybe he's like violent behind closed doors, because no one is that affable and good-natured and just like a good dude. You know, it's almost like superhumanly a kind person. But the thing is, to do Glenn, I had to wake up like early for me to catch that flight, right? When I am don't get my sleep, because one of the blessings, and I use that word advisedly, one of the blessings I have, and you have as well, is I don't have an alarm clock. And I do not take this for granted. I think I'm very fortunate that I'm in this position. I go to bed at 2 a.m, I wake up at 11, Monday through Sunday. So when that sleep schedule is messed up, it does a number on me, number one. And number two is, when I don't get my sleep, I'm often very irritable. Just like all, you know, middle-aged women. So when I was, you know, doing Glenn, I don't want to say I was half asleep, but I certainly wasn't well-rested. And I think, you know, when you're doing like these interview type things, it's almost similar to doing stand-up in the sense that if you're trying to consciously remember your routine, you're going to stumble over it. But if you know it like the back of your hand, you can mentally check out and still deliver it perfectly. And in that case, it's even better because whatever part of that brain that is doing the work. I remember I had a job for a couple of days when I, you know, just graduated college, stuffing envelopes. And it was actually really fun after a while, because after, let's suppose, half an hour, your hands were just doing the work unthinking. And then you could just think about whatever you wanted. You could kind of have this separation. So I didn't have any idea at all. I mean, I knew it went well, but Glenn is always a very affable host, very generous, very kind, very friendly to me. The head of The Blaze even said that they're having an issue with having me there because I'm radicalizing the whole staff. Like, they're all, because the difference, but The Blaze is, you know, people think that The Blaze and Newsmax and OAN and Fox interchangeable, and that's completely nonsensical. You know, that's like saying all the factions of the Libertarian Party are the same. Even if they all agree on the issues, they're still temperamentally very different.
Yeah, and so, Trump is not Bob Dole. You know,
yeah,
there's
exactly
a difference in the Republican Party. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a great, or even Ted Cruz, right? Even if the two of them voted, I mean,
yeah,
who's, you're going to have a dinner, you're going to have an extremely different experience. Even if on issues, they're going to vote the same way. So the thing with The Blaze is it's a very fun environment. Everyone there is really, really enjoys their job. They're having a good time. Like in Fox, I think there's much more of this like kind of bunker mentality, because Fox is much more of a target nationally, whereas The Blaze is kind of on the side doing their own thing. And let's not forget, let's give credit to Eric July. Eric July is an anarchist. He has a show on The Blaze. Everyone loves Eric. You know, he's a great, great dude.
Yeah.
I love talking to him. So they mean it when they want some kind of range of opinion. And the thing is, I got to tell you, in many ways, Glenn Beck is closer to Alex Jones than people realize. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but that when you've been in the center of the beast and you see how the propaganda machine works, it's very hard to take a step back and argue Republican versus Democrat at that point. It's like a joke at that point, that like thinking that, you know what, if we just had 50 Mitch McConnells, you know, then we're going to free America. Like, you can't say this with a straight face. Even you and I can't, let alone someone who's been on the inside as much as Glenn Beck. So I didn't really think much of it. I went on to do Sarah's show right after that. I always enjoy talking to him because he's a big shot. It's a huge sign of respect and like a sense of you've arrived that, you know, someone, he doesn't need to talk to me. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, there's no shortage of people that Glenn Beck can talk to. So for someone like him to sit and take my ideas seriously and to treat me with respect, it's flattering. It would be flattering to anybody.
Well, I'll say just along those lines that, as you know, as an author, you can often tell when you're on the radio, let's say, with somebody, which hosts have read just the bullet points in the press release and which hosts have actually cracked open the book and looked through it. And so when Glenn Beck had me on for Meltdown, and I knew what the different bullet points were, and by that point I was pretty ready to answer all of those if they asked me. And he wasn't asking any of those. He was asking me things that showed that either he or somebody on the staff, but yeah, I suspect he, went really dug deep into this thing and pulled out some interesting nuggets that weren't in the press materials. And that always impressed me about him, that I felt like this guy, I know, you know, he gets made fun of and libertarians would make fun of him. I thought that was a mistake, that he's shown over the years that he's willing to change his mind if he thinks he's wrong, and he's willing to listen to arguments and ideas he hasn't heard before. And I can't say that for Sean Hannity. I can't. When has Sean Hannity ever said, you know, I've really, really thought deeply and profoundly about this, and I think I need to move in a different direction? The very thought never enters his mind.
Yeah, and there's no incentive for Sean Hannity to do that.
Yeah.
With Glenn, there is a bit of an incentive because he's doing his own thing. And now, at the very least, he'll be able to create his own market as an alternative to Fox or Newsmax or something like that. The other thing, which I think is a big advantage, and, you know, I mentioned it to Glenn early in the interview, is he really is a student of history. Now, I'm nowhere near as much of a historian as you. You obviously have degrees and so on and so forth. But whenever I hear conservatives say explicitly, this is their expression, we have to go back to the Constitution. When are you imagining this period where the Constitution was working? And I had this tweet and the midwits came out in full force, like, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. Because I said, the problem with the Constitution is that it depends on politicians acting in good faith. And everyone's like, oh my God, that's the opposite. The whole point is that they're not acting good faith. No, 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 no. The point is, if it says Congress shall make no law, everyone in Washington will be able to tell you with a straight face and lying through their teeth, oh, we're not making a law. This isn't a law. This is an edict or a bill. They're lawyers. Their entire job is to tell you that what is the plain written word is in fact not what it says. In fact, we heard this not that long ago, that it says, well, the First Amendment is there to protect political speech. Where does it say that? Like, if even if that's true, what is your basis for this? Number one. And number two, as you know perfectly well, the very first speech that they went after was political speech, the Sedition Act.
Yeah.
So you always make this point about how, you know, like John Marshall and all these other people, like, I wonder what they could have meant. We know what they meant. They had debates. They're written down. The Constitution wasn't a Ouija board where we got these words on Mount Zion and we got to deduce, you know, I wonder what they meant by militia and well-regulated. I guess they mean the FDA. But it's completely disingenuous. And that's what I mean by you are never going to have a political class that is going to take the written word that is supposedly an impediment to their power and accept those impediments. In fact, right now, after Joe Manchin said he's not going to vote for the Biden bill, where the Democrats have a 50-50 split in the Senate, Democrat after Democrat after Democrat is like, we have to change the system basically in order to get this bill through. It's like, if you believed in fairness, a term which means nothing, but if you believed in fairness, then you would see these rules are there for both sides, right? But they don't care.
This is why chapter 21 of the Anarchist Handbook is so important. That's the John Hasnas chapter.
Oh, yeah.
The myth of the rule of law. One of the most difficult articles for me fully to accept. I read it at the time, or I read it in like 1992, I think. And wow. I met him that year. That's how I read it. He was reviewing it with us at an Institute for Humane Studies seminar. And I just refused to believe it. His basic thesis was, we all have this idea that thanks to the state, we have, quote unquote, the rule of law, which means you are ruled by laws, not by men. And as my friend Marco Bassani said, I'd rather be ruled by good men than bad laws. But okay, it's the rule of law, not of men. All right, that means that we can write words down. And since those words have an objective meaning,
right,
we know that the judges will give us predictable, regular results that'll be unbiased and whatever. And it that is just not how it works and can't ever work. It's not like, if only I could just narrow the wording down somehow or be even more precise. It doesn't work that way. And that chapter is going to stay with you. If you don't agree with it right away, fine. It's going to take up residence in your brain until eventually you do.
And the thing about that chapter, which I regard as the probably greatest anarchist essay ever written, he uses real law school examples.
Yes.
So he's not doing hypotheticals like, Tom, you and I are in Desert Island and property rights and Ayn Rand's along. No, no. I'll give one example which she uses, which perfectly illustrates this point. There's some old lady who signed up to get like samba lessons. And basically the guy convinced her to pay him like for samba lessons for 50 years at like $10,000, some obscene number, right? And there was a lawsuit. And there's two possible answers here. One is, this is ridiculous. It's a swindle. We're not going to enforce this contract against this old lady. Not that there's any at all pretense that she's senile or anything. That's not the case. She's clearly of sound mind, but they're saying, no, we're not going to enforce this contract. This is way above the market rate. It doesn't make sense. The alternative answer is, it's not the state's job to nullify contracts. She signed this. She knew what she was signing. She's got to pay. Everyone listening to this can easily make the case for both of those sides. And that is why this whole concept of objective law, you know, extrapolated, is incoherent. Because to begin with, if there's a lawsuit in many cases, there is a gray area and it's not at all clear. There's justice and there's the written law and it's a Venn diagram, but they're not, you know, concentric circles.
Yeah. And when something like this, as foundational as the quote unquote rule of law is to the mythology of the state, if that falls in your mind, then you're not going to worry about who's going to build the roads. You'll figure that out. But you'll know that something is wrong. And well, so now I want to ask you another thing.
I know, just also one more thing. The idea that somehow rich people won't have access to better lawyers than poor people, that won't give them an advantage. How do you work around that? It's not possible.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, couldn't they say, well, how about from now on, we'll just have the state subsidize all the lawyers and provide them to everybody on an egalitarian basis?
I mean, yeah, unless you have a government monopoly, but in that case, I don't think anyone's going to be happy.
Yeah.
That's everyone's equally unhappy, yeah.
And geez, anybody who's been involved in the legal system at all. I mean, first of all, if you're involved in a civil case, it's going to take a million years and you're going to hate the whole process and so on. But on the criminal side too, I mean, we saw with Kyle Rittenhouse, but what the key thing about Kyle Rittenhouse is all the unknown Rittenhouses out there, black and white, who are getting railroaded behind closed doors and being pressured into entering pleas and whatever. Who even knows the depths of the corruption there? And yet kids are still taught in the government schools about the way it works and all these ideal pie-in-the-sky theoretical arguments about the state that bear zero resemblance to how it carries itself out every
day. And it's simple game theory. If there's the possibility, however low, that I'm facing life in prison as he was, and the alternative is to cop a plea for 5 years, it's very easy to make that argument for copping the plea, even if you're totally innocent.
Yeah.
And then it becomes, in the eyes of the masses, well, why'd you plead guilty then?
Right. So your life is destroyed because the presumption of guilt is following you for the rest of your life.
Yeah. But it's not even presumption. You admitted it. You pled guilty.
Yeah. That's a good point. It's a good point.
You should have fought.
All right. Let's take a quick break to thank our sponsor, Blinkist. Now, I know you've heard me talk about Blinkist before, but listen to me. I'm about to make your life and your brain much better. Now, it's true, by now, many of you know that Blinkist is an app that takes thousands of important nonfiction titles and summarizes them for you in 15-minute so-called blinks that you can either read or listen to. This means they get rid of all the fluff and give you just what you need to know. And you may find you want to read that whole book. You may also find this book would be a waste of my time. Blinkist offers titles on all different subjects from all different perspectives. They even have a book by me, Meltdown. They have Murray Rothbard's For a New Liberty or Economic Facts and Fallacies by Thomas Sowell. Go read that book, then listen to the blink, and the information will stay in your head more effectively. Honestly, I think Sowell is one of the best writers I have ever come across, and he has such a sharp mind, and he's such a great economist. And Blinkist gives you a great way to get your feet wet with Thomas Sowell's material. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. All right, here's what I want to ask you. My approach generally is as follows. I think of anarchism as simply as a world without politics. I think politics is evil, I was going to say zero sum. It's actually net negative. It does not make a positive contribution to your life. Just think of COVID and just apply it to every single thing. And it's COVID on a smaller scale. It's just crazy senselessness derived from ideas cooked up in universities by lunatics. Politics is not the basis on which I want to interact with other people. And so anarchism simply, to me, means a private property order where there's no official institution that's given the right to expropriate me or push me around. But if I use the word anarchism, and here's my question, if I use it just in colloquial usage day to day, no one is going to interpret me as meaning that. They're going to think I mean either that I want to throw bombs, you know, I want to be Alexander Berkman, or they'll think I'm a leftist who just hates corporations or something and wants to shut them down, but is okay with the welfare state, like so-called quote-unquote anarchist Noam Chomsky. Well, what institution is going to be enforcing the welfare state? I don't get any of that, but my question is, how, if you just walk around and say, I'm an anarchist, say, I wouldn't want somebody even for a second to confuse me with people like that. I want it to be understood, I am a defender of property, not a dynamiter of property.
Oh, I disagree. I think it's obviously, I always say anarchist, and I think you and I are very different people, obviously. I think you and I agree, and everyone listening to this agrees, that the vast majority of people in this country believe and have been trained to believe that politics is binary, that like if you go after Biden, all they have to do is show that Trump is worse, and therefore Biden's position has been demonstrated.
Yeah.
So if you are outside this binary, they don't know where to put you. And for some people, it's off-putting, confusing. For some people, it's intriguing. So that, I think, is of use. It's also useful for me, for people to think I'm a bomb thrower, because taking one look at me, it's clear I'm not someone who's about to start a riot.
Yeah.
So that also, you even more.
I was thinking that because of, you know, my suit and tie and whatever. Yeah. If I tell them I'm an anarchist, it really blows their minds.
Right. It's like, what? What does he think it means? That's why it's really funny when some of them are like, oh, you'd be the first one killed in your anarchist utopia. It's like, first of all, it's a utopia. Why is anyone getting killed? But that's neither here nor there.
Right.
So I do find that useful. And also, I think you and I have a different approach. And I think we've discussed this before. You're more of a open door kind of person. And I'm more of a velvet rope kind of person. Whenever possible, I try to be off-putting to randos because I don't think that they're a net benefit. So for example, when I was on Tim Pool a couple of years ago, I had a propeller beanie on. I always tried to look as much like a goofball as possible because then I'll hear things like, anyone who wears a hat like that has nothing of interest to say. Great. If that's your metric for thinking whether someone has something interesting to say, their wardrobe, go away. We're never going to get anywhere. Whereas the kind of people who are higher on the openness metric, who when they see something unusual are intrigued by it, those are my people because they're going to be much more receptive to an innovative worldview.
Why do you avoid the term anarcho-capitalism?
Because I think that the original anarchists, I'm closer to them in many ways. I don't want to sound like I'm a straight up Rothbardian, because the same way it's like, you know, you avoid the term anarchist because I think certain things. If I say Rothbardian, I say certain things. I'm much more of a Randian than a Rothbardian. And it's kind of wordy. And it's also funny to me that, you know, a lot of left anarchists really hate, and understandably from their perspective, the kind of what Rothbard did to anarchism. So I'm not going to give in to their sense of ownership of the label. And I have an enormous amount of admiration for people like Bakunin and the others.
Have you, let's say on social media, gotten response from left anarchists to the anarchist handbook? Are they happy to see that it's done well, or are they unhappy that...
Very few.
Okay.
You know, some of them are ass mad, and more power to them. There's nothing they can do about it. And I would give more credence to their disquiet if the anarchist handbook wasn't representative of the original anarcho-communists. But they're all in there. And there's no pretense that these people are the devil or they don't know what they're talking about. They're there, their words, to present their point of view. And I'm sure you've seen the Bakunin essay from 1867, where he eviscerates Marx 50 years before the Soviet Union was created and predicted exactly what it's going to look like. I think it's just absolutely superb. So I was very pleased how many anarcho-capitalists are appreciating the works of the original anarchists.
I have to admit, you know, I knew of them secondhand because I know some intellectual history, but I hadn't read that many of them in their own words, basically, to be honest with you, until you came along.
Oh, wow.
So I did that also. And then, of course, you and I did that episode on Emma Goldman some time ago. And we actually did an episode on your book, but we did it not really on the contents of the book, but on the book as a phenomenon and how unexpectedly insane the book went in terms of sales, and everybody was talking about it. And I remember when you first told me the idea for it, I thought, well, that's a really, really great idea. Good for Michael. That's going to be good for him. It never in a million years occurred to me that it would happen quite like this. And so the reason we didn't do an episode on the content really was we wanted to wait for the audiobook to be available so that people could snatch that up. And now that it is, now we're really going to blast it. So take, as we wrap up for today, do you want to take a minute and tell people what's unique about the audiobook version?
Sure. Thaddeus Russell and I both share an enormous contempt for the Protestant work ethic. This claim that if you're working hard, that's somehow inherently moral. I'd rather have a plumber solve my clogged toilet in 2 seconds than someone who works really hard for 2 hours. So it was win-win because I was going to read the whole audiobook. And then I thought to myself, hold on. These are, you know, 22 different authors. It would make much more sense to have 22 different readers because their voices are very varied. They disagreed on many things. So I hit the Rolodex hard. And every chapter is read by a different, you know, prominent talker. So I put together a great cast. And only after it was done was I like, holy crap, I really pulled something off that's pretty impressive here.
And I read the Rothbard chapter, Anatomy of the State, read by Woods. And I was pretty timely. I didn't want you to be the guy you had to chase after.
You did superb job and you brought it, you delivered it mastered. It was flawless.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you. So you guys are going to love this. You know, audiobooks, I've actually sort of been converted to them a little bit.
Wait,
if
can
you
I
get
ask
the right
you,
narrator.
It must have been a thrill for you. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm guessing it was a thrill for you to be the one who's the voice of Rothbard for so many people.
Oh, it was. I mean, because in fact, back in the mid-1990s when I was but a pup, I was at the Mises Institute for a summer and I compiled the index for a couple of Rothbard's posthumous compilations. And as a kid, that was about all I could aspire to. But I thought, well, this is actually pretty darn good. But then to read, be the guy who... Oh, and I wrote the introduction to, again, a posthumously published manuscript, his book, The Betrayal of the American Right. I wrote the introduction to that. So these little connections to him are a lot of fun. And I'm really grateful that you asked me to do it. I was very happy to do it.
And it was also great because I got to spite Dave Smith.
Oh, how so?
Well, because now he had to read David Friedman.
Oh, okay. I didn't know what Dave wound up doing.
Yeah, he did David Friedman. Friedman doesn't regard himself as utilitarian, but I thought it was funny to have Dave Smith give the quote-unquote utilitarian argument for anarcho-capitalism.
Smith strikes me as the type you had to chase around a little. Am I right?
No.
Oh, really? He got it in right on time?
There was no right on time. It was, you know, I was herding like 20 cats. Everyone is very busy. These are big shots. So, and the thing with the chapters you and Dave did and Lysander Spooner, which was Camille Foster, those are very long. So I could not at all, you know, be standing there. Where is it, guys? Like I had to be.
Yeah, no, of course.
I had to be respectful of people's time and very grateful that they felt comfortable contributing to this project.
Yeah, I just want to be superior to Dave in some area. So I thought this
might
be
the tallest dwarf.
Short people have to aspire to something.
Yeah.
All right. So the book, of course, is The Anarchist Handbook. I'm going to link to it on every single show notes page this week. So this one
and
is...
And they can pick it up at anarchistaudiobook.com.
Oh, at anarchistaudiobook.com. Also tomwoods.com/2036. All right. Thanks a lot, Michael.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, folks. Don't forget, check out tomwoodsannouncement.com if you want to be the first to hear my key announcement. And I won't be making it on the podcast. I actually will not be making the announcement on the podcast because by the time I make the announcement and by the time it gets out to the podcast world, the moment will have passed. So I will not be making the announcement on the podcast. So if you want to know what it is and it's the most important thing I've announced and it could affect you, then head over to tomwoodsannouncement.com and sign up to be the first to hear about it. All right, more Michael Malice tomorrow. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.